encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Must Be Made podcast. Filling in for hosting duties today, it's Nathan Heinschel. But joining me in a twist is still Colin Dams and Paulie Questel. Fellas, how are we doing?
We've been better.
Well, Colin's playing injured. We were ready to do a nice fun one following up on a derby and like a meh win, and then it just went to shit.
Yeah. I mean, like I appreciate Michael Olise. He's a fun player to watch. Part of a Palace attack that I think more often than not has been pretty fun to watch. They've been in bad form lately though, and it's pretty disappointing that we weren't able to capitalize on that. But still riding a little high on the derby win. Still got an exciting game at the weekend, albeit without one of our best players, but we'll get into that.
It's weird because it's ultimately they drop points because of a moment of magic, which we've seen before. We've seen this game before, not so much this season, but like Wolves a few years ago comes to mind, where United got a 1-0 lead. They missed a couple of chances to make it 2 or 3-0. And then Ruben Neves hits a worldie. And like, it happens. That's why you go and score the second goal, to account for what, you know, maybe a moment of magic happens. It's so classic football, because early in the season, United were like asking for this. They were being bad against bad teams and basically being like, sure, you're in complete control of this match and it's 1-0, but you know, any moment can change this. And now that moment does come, but it comes when they're on a good run and in a game where really they did more than enough to win.
Well, so I suppose we'll eat our vegetables and then we'll get back to dessert, which was the derby win over the weekend. Of course, we're recording this roughly about 30 minutes after the final whistle. United won, Crystal Palace won. I don't know. It felt like some bad habits creep back in during this match. Of course, it sandwiched in between two colossal matchups of Manchester City this past weekend and then Arsenal upcoming, is this Crystal Palace game that shouldn't have happened. But of course it was not played earlier in the season because of the Queen's passing and not being able to muster enough security to host a Premier League match in London at that time.
But maybe that's why this happened. Like, ball don't lie situation. Had they played this match in September when it was originally scheduled, this would have been the prime United aren't winning, but aren't doing enough to win. And a moment of magic could end up with a bad result. And I think if they would have played this match in September, United probably don't win it.
Yeah, no, that was the first thought that I had too. I was like, I don't feel like we were destined to get 3 points out of this match either way. It just hurts more now because of the run of form that we're on. But Crystal Palace are tenacious. Patrick Vieira is coaching them up to play exactly like the way they play. They disrupted. United did not let them get comfortable. United would get wasteful with their chances. And it just allowed them to stay in the game and then have that moment of magic that we talked about. Of course,
it's disappointing because Palace aren't, that is the perception of Palace, because that's what they were last year. And if you haven't been watching Palace, you'd be like, yeah, they're probably, you know, just doing that, but being up and down, but like, they really have been bad this year. And they really did exactly what Patrick Vieira is aiming for them to do tonight. They were up for the match, and that's kind of what happens when you're Manchester United, is you go away from home and you're everybody's cup final. That's the price of being a big club. They were up for it. You know, they'll play Nottingham Forest or whoever next, and they'll be terrible again. That's the way the cookie crumbles. And yeah, United were a bit wasteful. Nathan's right that there were some bad habits that were coming out. I think the lack of depth in the squad really came out today. I guess it comes out every time that Ten Hag makes his changes in the second half, when it's just like, what are you going to do? And, oh, this is what you're doing. Like Scott McTominay coming out as the number 10 today is.
Yeah, I was going
to. You make fun of that, but a week ago, 2 weeks ago, it was Donny van de Beek coming on to be useless. So it's not like, you know, van de Beek had a really bad injury and he's going to miss the rest of the season, but it's not like anybody was missing him. So already just Donny van de Beek having to come on showed the lack of depth in the squad. And I think also,
but it's like, what was McTominay's job when he came on? I mean, I guess right. maybe yeah, like he's playing, continue he's playing disrupting as the number things 10. Further up the pitch, but it's like, I had no idea what his job was at the time, because it seemed like, to me at least, what needed to be remedied was that Crystal Palace were starting to gain momentum. They were possessing the ball a little bit more further up the pitch. Whereas in the first half, they had the ball. They kind of got forward sometimes, but for the most part, if they were involved, the ball was in the middle of the park. From, I guess, the hour mark on until basically the end of the game, Crystal Palace really looked dangerous and United could barely do anything going forward. So I don't know how Scott McTominay fixes that, but like you said, it's not like he has a lot of people off the bench who, like, I understand why he wanted to replace Matt Weghorst, but also Anthony Martial wasn't available today. I think he picked up an injury against City. So
he was already injured.
McTominay was there to draw penalties.
We'll get there. It's sort of been a theme all season, though. Like, Christian Eriksen can't play 90 minutes. We know that. But Christian Eriksen in a midfield pivot is already not the most foundational thing. Like, this is what we've been talking about all season. Like, Casemiro covers so many things. And I've said this to you. I've said this to a lot of people, is if you watch every match, basically every goal and every good chance that we concede starts with Casemiro missing a tackle. And it's like Casemiro misses one, two tackles a match. And somehow every time he does, it turns into the opponent's best chance of the match. That's how much he's covering. Like, that speaks to how much
his
duct tape he yeah. is, because as soon as you break through that line of defense, United seem to look lost every time. Now, today it was a set piece and can't really blame him for that. It was a remarkable set piece, but Eriksen and Casemiro, not the most foundational midfield. So we see this every game of things start to get more open and you need to bring on another player. And like, Fred is a much more defensive player than Eriksen, and he's much better defensively. Not the most person you bring on for stability. And if you notice, like, the game seemed to get more open when Fred comes on. United don't concede many chances, and they didn't concede chances against Crystal Palace today. Like, Crystal Palace didn't. They had quote unquote chances, but they didn't get shots off on them. So, like, their defenders defended. And that's what's been happening all season long. And I've been talking to you guys about this of like I don't want to blame this on Scott McTominay, because it's not his fault, but I've been talking about how United's attacking numbers are just like shooting up when Christian Eriksen isn't on the pitch. And it is a very small sample size, but every single game there's another 15, 20 minutes added to the sample size, and United keeps scoring in those 15, 20 minutes. And that just, they bring on McTominay today, and that just kind of takes that ability away, because it was a really good example. At one point, Palace made a bad pass. Garnacho intercepted it and starts running down the wing, and McTominay just takes off. And Garnacho's 1v1, but he now has no one to pass to. Like, the middle of the pitch is wide open if he needs support, but there's nobody there because your number 10 just ran beyond Rashford and went beyond the defensive line. He took himself out of the play. Like, Garnacho was never in a position where he's going to be able to play a through ball, but McTominay just ran through everything, and Rashford was aware and finally dropped back to help Garnacho. But that's what McTominay does. He makes those runs in, and if you get him the ball, he might get a header, or he might have that nice finish like he did in the League Cup earlier this season. You know, almost like a Jozy Altidore first touch smash but he's not going to facilitate play. He's not going to be, you can't get him the ball and then ask him to make a pass. So like when he makes a nice run and gives you an option, cool, but like what's going to happen next? And it doesn't really facilitate scoring that second goal, where at the same time, you're now, Ten Hag was obviously reluctant to bring Fred into the match, especially after Casemiro picked up the yellow, which he ended up doing anyway. But like that doesn't bolster the team. Like you just end up playing this back and forth match, but with a guy who can't really lead you on counterattacks and make that pass that'll help you score the second goal, while also you're not consolidating and I'm at a loss for words, clogging up the midfield. Like, as Colin said, to like try to regain that control back in the match. So I just don't know. So like I'm right there with Colin. I'm like, I just don't know what McTominay is supposed to bring in that situation.
I think part of it too is he came on alongside Alejandro Garnacho, who has been kind of a spark plug off the bench as, you know, as a contributor, a regular contributor. He now is in the squad. He's been a very useful substitute. And part of the reason why, I think, is because when he gets involved late, he kind of does what Rashford does early in the games, and he makes those runs off the left-hand side, but he also gets Marcus Rashford back involved, because when Rashford moves central, usually he kind of has that player to play off him and do some of the work that he doesn't have to do anymore. And he kind of makes himself as, you know, the central option again. Whereas if McTominay is that central option, you're just pushing everything out wide again, and you're creating that chasm that we talked about earlier in the season when it came to, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo starting games. I still think some of the problems United had later against Palace were further back on the pitch. It seemed like in midfield they just kind of started losing that battle. But, there's all sorts of things that could be contributing to that. It's like, it's not just lack of depth. I think they've played a lot of games in January by this point. I think they've played 7 games, and they still have 2 more to play in January before it's over. So hopefully it's one they can learn from. They're going to have to learn from it quick, because they may have to, you know, dig back in terms of blueprints to face this Arsenal team. I don't know if a McTominay-Eriksen pivot again is going to be that exciting, but or even if Arsenal won't have a plan for figuring that out again, because they weren't far away from doing it back in September. So, we'll see.
I think you're going to get the return of McFred on Sunday. I think he goes with McFred, and Eriksen pushes up to the 10. And Bruno starts out wide. And I think that helps mitigate some issues, whether it's Weghorst up front, Martial up front, Rashford out on the left. That helps mitigate some of these issues that you know are going to happen at towards the end of the game, of Christian Eriksen needs to come off and you're going to want to change things. So it allows you to bring on Antony, move Bruno centrally, bring on Garnacho, and you can move Rashford centrally if that's what you want. But it allows you to now move into this more attacking, more we could, if you are holding a lead, we could pick you off on the counter because we have the right guys in the right positions, rather than, you know, a guy who has, we don't have anybody to bring on. So we bring on the one academy kid that we have, who's like one of the older players in the squad at this point. And who's, you know, Ten Hag was quoted as saying before the United scored against City, his substitutions were going to be Lisandro Martinez and Scott McTominay. Martinez to allow Shaw to become a left back and McTominay to provide energy. And like, you've got a guy who has played as a 6, an 8, a 10, a 9 this season. And the big quality that he has is energy. Like, that's just not good enough.
Well, and if we're starting to think about the Arsenal match as well, and now the puzzle pieces that Ten Hag
We should talk about the derby at some point, though, because it was
dessert, Colin. It's dessert. So we've seen, and this is something that's kind of sprouting in my head right now, and if this is too kooky, just let me know. Recently, as recent as
are the you derby, gonna are you gonna do are you gonna bring up what you texted us this morning?
I don't think so.
There's a reason nobody answered that text.
So Luke Shaw, as recent as the Derby, has been playing left center back. With Casemiro missing, what do you guys think that Ten Hag tries something different where Shaw plays center back, Malacia plays left back, and then he moves Martinez into the midfield to play kind of that central defensive midfielder role?
I don't think he does it. I wouldn't rule out Shaw playing at center back, though. And Malacia, it depends on where he sees the threat. He spoke about why he played Shaw there on Sunday or Saturday. And he mentioned things about, like, you know, his awareness, his ability to spot runs and track them and move on and break up plays. And if that's where he sees the threat from Arsenal, I could see Shaw moving in. Malacia, as a raw defensive fullback, is better than Shaw defensively, and has some good recovery pace, which has always been Shaw's weakest part of his game. He's just not that fast. So I could, if he sees the threats being out on the wing where you do have Bukayo Saka, I could see Shaw moving inside and Malacia coming into the game. I don't think he puts Lisandro Martinez in midfield.
Sorry, I had to go look back in the text messages to find out what it was you sent us this morning that we didn't respond to, because I've been sleeping terribly since the surgery, so I actually did not even read that text this morning. So to answer your text first, I'm not sure, but I would like to see it anyway. And then to answer this, I actually responded to Sue Wade with the Lucas Shodrich, thinking, you know, maybe part of the plan would be Shaw moves up into midfield. I'm not sure that happens either, either him or Lisandro Martinez. I kind of agree with Paulie. I think we just resort to either McFred or what we had at the beginning of the season, which was the McTominay-Eriksen pivot, which is a boring answer for the sake of this conversation and the question that you posed, but also kind of safer, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, it's a boring answer, but also, like, where else are you going? It's not like there's somebody on the bench that everybody's clamoring to see. This is I started tweeting about this last week, and I spoke to Brent at the bar on Saturday about it, and a couple of other people. Where Erik ten Hag is really being hurt is the lack of investment in the academy, not recently, but 10, 15 years ago. And if you look at the ages of players, of academy players that have appeared in the match day squad for United this season, it's like 17, 18, 19, 19, 20, 25. That's Rashford. 26. That's McTominay. There's a massive gap between 20 and 25 of just people where the academy used to produce squad Tom players, right? Where the academy used to produce squad players, just players that could come in and do a job for you and come in. You're like, I mean, Nicky Butt gets thrown in there because he's class of 92, but like, that's what Nicky Butt was. Nicky Butt was just a hardworking player who came in and did a job and played very well. Darren Fletcher, John O'Shea, like, those players just don't exist for United anymore, which is difficult for Ten Hag because he doesn't have that ability to call on anybody. Like, there's the players in the academy right now, Iqbal and Kobbie Mainoo, like, those are 17, 19-year-old kids. They're not ready to play. That's fine. Like, maybe they become stars. Maybe they become squad players. We don't know. But in 2023, in January of 2023, like, they're not ready to be called upon. And, like, United started investing again in the academy in 2019, which is where they got Garnacho from and some of these other players that now they have a bright spot. But again, like, other than Garnacho, who has come on the scene very well, like, you can't expect 18 and 19 year olds to be ready to produce at this level. And there is just nobody, as Brent said, it's the Cameron Borthwick Jackson, Timothy Fosu-Mensah generation is just completely lost. Like, people blame Jose Mourinho. Like, Jose Mourinho had nothing to work with the players that he actually put on the pitch, because he did at times, are all terrible, and they're all gone, and there's a reason why he wasn't playing any of them. And Van Gaal really tried to put – Van Gaal threw as many academy players as he could onto the pitch, and all of them were garbage. And now Erik ten Hag's paying the price for that because he doesn't have these players available to him, which means United also have to buy all their depth, which is very difficult to do, and it costs money. And that money that it could be spent on – that is being spent on – that could be spent on higher – degree players being spent on depth, like it's part of like why we're hemorrhaging money, because we need to buy, you know, 20 players in our squad. We can't just round out. We're not buying 14 players and having six guys round out the squad. And it's that we have financial issues to begin with, it makes challenging for a title so difficult.
Yeah. We have to keep making those purchases of like, who can fix this now? And sometimes that guy's already 26, 27, or, you know, like Casemiro or Matic, they're 30. And, you know, those are purchases that work out for a while, but...
Right, and then you have to make the same purchase again.
Yeah.
While exactly. Nobody comes in to, like, fill the need. And you look at it like, okay, who's the best one that's come through? Like, they hit one out of the park with Marcus Rashford. Like, that doesn't happen. You get that maybe once a decade that you get Marcus Rashford. And I know people are going to be like, well, they also got Greenwood. But like, as I said, Greenwood didn't work out. There are many reasons why academy players don't pan out. Sometimes they just don't make the step up. Sometimes, you know, they get distracted off the pitch. Sometimes it's injury. Sometimes it's being a shit human. And for what, you know, Mason Greenwood did not turn out to be a Manchester United player, but Marcus Rashford did. But look at how they treated him. He broke in as a striker, and then they moved him to left wing, and promptly, a year and a half later, spent a ton of money to sign Alexis Sanchez to play at that left wing. And all the while, they spent God only knows how much on striker after striker after striker after striker. Like, just leave, like, if you just leave him as your striker there, perhaps, like, think about all that money that you maybe don't have to spend to now that could have gone elsewhere into the squad.
Nathan sending us another hot take on text message.
And now you're left, like, now you're left with the three most senior academy players in the squad, and don't count Tom Heaton. You have McTominay, Rashford, and Anthony Elanga, who can't even get off the bench. Erik ten Hag he clearly does not rate him. I would say two of those three guys are two of the worst three players in the squad. That's a problem for the academy that they've tried. They are addressing. They have fixed it. They're signing better players now. They're doing a better job there, but that's still going to take about 3 years before it really starts to bear fruit for us.
Well, and if rumors are to be to believe, the problem of Anthony Elanga might soon be Dortmund's. So that might be kind of cool.
Right, but there's your difference. It's on a loan. Like, whereas all these other teams managed to sell their academy players, United get there on loan for the other team to be like, oh, you're not that good.
Oh, you mean like Teeth Chong and Axel Tuanzebe and
Adnanyanazai and you know, just Gomez. Keep naming them. Gomez left, and like,
to be fair, I was going to bring this up when you were talking earlier, Polly. Angel Gomez has actually turned into a pretty good player. The problem is, I think that development for him happened as soon as he left Manchester United.
Angel Gomez was the one guy I was like, he looked like very promising. I was always like, we should be playing him more.
Yeah, he had the technical ability. Take a step back to be like,
I remember that match against Astana, the home one, so the first one in the Europa League, where I was like, Angel Gomez was the best player on the pitch. Why are you taking him off? And I was like, well, it's also 0-0 and he's an attacker. So like, he might've been the best player on the pitch, but he's not exactly making an impact. But then he wanted to leave. He refused to sign a new contract. Like, what are you going to do there? And like, while he might be a good player, I don't think United are like, damn, how did we let him get away? Like, people, again, like I tweeted this and everybody started being like, well, what about this guy? What about this guy? And it's like, well, most of these guys are
who's going to play
over academy, not contributing to the first team yet. Like, they're still too young, and everybody else, like, for some reason, if you say that the United Academy has been bad over the last 10 years, which it has, it's only recently, you know, they went 10 years between winning FA Youth Cups. People get so offended by it. It's like the proof is in the pudding. Like, where are our players? They're not here. They're not even in the Premier League anymore. It used to be, if you looked at the bottom half of the table, it was filled with Academy graduates from Manchester United.
Yeah. And even some of the guys who would be Academy age, we purchased for real money, like Facundo Pellistri, who's only, you know, starting to be in the 18, and Amad Diallo, who continues to not play for Manchester United. So,
I mean, they spent real money on Hannibal and on Garnacho. And I think Garnacho was like 100K, but like they spent 10 million on Hannibal. Like, so yeah, they've started investing in the academy that maybe it'll get better. It'll get good. But again, like that takes time to wait, and you need all those players to pan out, and then you need them to be of age to contribute. And these days it's like, there's just no one.
That's why we got to beat Liverpool to hiring Jude Bellingham's dad as a coach in the academy system, and then signing Jude Bellingham's brother into the academy.
And renaming the academy after Jude Bellingham.
Welcome to Carrington Fields.
Jimmy Murphy can go kick rocks.
But these are all conversations for later this year.
Anyway, that's not why we lost. Apparently we lost. As you can see, we dropped points today. United fans doing what they do, what they always do, and just immediately, oh, don't look inward. It's clearly the ref's fault. We got denied a stone cold penalty, even though it was pretty.
I thought it was really funny, actually, that somebody was like, United dropped these 2 points that could have moved them in the second, and also Casemiro is out at the weekend. I'm really buying into this idea that everything is moving towards Arsenal. And I'm like,
yeah,
their whole existence on Twitter has been that everything is working against them. Like, does everyone have
I posted the picture right away. It looked like the defender got his stud on the ball very, very slightly.
I think that's a
clear case of, if you give the penalty, you're definitely not overturning it. And if you don't give the penalty, it doesn't get overturned either. Like,
there's no ruling of error on the referee's part.
It could have gone either way. And like, getting a stud on the ball is enough to not be a penalty. The Casemiro one, that's the big one for Arsenal. And I guess you're thankful that it wasn't like a poor referee decision. Like, if it's a poor referee, if Casemiro gets like a bogus yellow,
yeah,
you'd be mad. In this particular case, it was like, you're a veteran player, you should have known better. And he brought it upon himself. The sequence starts with him making a blind, terrible pass that gets intercepted, and he has to then go and tackle a guy. And it's like, you should have known better, and you should have been better. Like, you're a veteran, you're getting trusted in this situation. I do think they were making a bit too much of a big deal. Like,
I feel like we watched that in slow motion, right? Like, as he is committing the pass, you're like, oh no.
They're making like a very big deal about it. Like, oh, he's got four yellows, and it's like, he has four yellows in how many games? So in how many matches has he not gotten a yellow? And in all those matches, he has not gotten a second yellow. So
is this the one that it resets for too?
Yeah. Yeah. Literally, if he made it 10 more minutes, it would have reset.
That's how few yellows he does get. So,
and it's just like, he is a couple matches ago, he got a yellow like 15 minutes into the match. He's a veteran player. He should know how to handle himself and do that. Like, I thought that it was almost ridiculous how many people were asking Erik ten Hag if you're even going to play him. And I remember 2 years ago when we went to Anfield in this exact like 19th game situation, and 4 days before that, we had to go to Turf Moor to play Burnley. And the game before that, Maguire picked up his fourth yellow on like a very dumb, like, I shoved you out of the way when I never should have yellow. And they were like, is Solskjaer going to they asked Solskjaer, like, are you going to play Maguire? Because if he gets another yellow, then you're going to miss him for the Anfield trip. And he was like, no, of course I'm going to play. Like, he's just, he's got to be responsible and he's not going to get booked. And he didn't.
I'd like to give a shout out to, as far, we were talking about takes stemming from this match. One of my favorite Galaxy Brain takes that I saw so far was somebody already complaining about Weghorst, who in a perfect world would have not started tonight. they were like, so we could have just gotten that from Ronaldo, but then it would have been, we were playing a serial winner and not somebody who got relegated in the Premier League. And I was blown away by that take. So shout outs to you for, you know, having a brain so just like toxically corroded that you could come up with that. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're gonna start laying into him, this was his first game after training for 2 days. So it looked like a front three that hadn't really played together, and that's what it
is. I thought
is.
He did well.
Yeah, he, I mean, he created the space for Bruno on the first goal. I thought
there were some moments early in the first half where it was like we're whipping in crosses that we normally don't whip in, and it was like, oh, trying to get it to the big guy.
It kind of went back to on the corner strategy. It went back to the Harry Maguire, just put it near his head kind of feeling.
Yeah. To be fair, they focused a lot in the pre-match right before kickoff of showing Weghorst on the field, and I don't think I saw a single United player's forehead reach above where his shoulders are. So I get it. They wanted to play with the new toy a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, he's a big lad.
Definitely like, the big lad.
I would like to see him get some big lad goals. It didn't happen today. There was a good cross from Shaw that set him up for one. I think he just didn't time his header right, and it was a little bit behind him. But he showed he's got decent technical ability. You know, the Kevin Durant thing of better than you'd expect for somebody that tall. But he's, I don't think he's going to come in and drastically change everything that we do in attack. But
well, I mean, we can't expect him to.
He's a reliable body that we can play up top, and he's shown that he's not going to eat up the spaces that Ronaldo did that hindered the games of Antony, Rashford, and Bruno Fernandes. So as long as, you know, everyone is still able to do their thing, it shouldn't interfere too much.
Well, I'll put my host hat back on. Does anybody got any additional takeaways they'd like to bring up with the Crystal Palace game or heading into Arsenal before we move on to the derby?
Nah, I just kind of want to treat this game as like a bump in the road, you know. I hope that it's not the start of an unraveling of form where we have to figure a bunch of things out again, as I guess is all I hope, but I don't think it'll be that.
Yeah, I would say for anybody who's freaking out on social media right now, it feels like a loss, but it wasn't. So at the end of the day, like, winning streaks do end. They are designed to end. Unless I guess you're, what, the 1987 Lakers? So a point is still important. This team, if you use the T word, sit in timeout for a little bit, that was really premature. I don't know why, just because you beat the second place team that we thought as a third place team, that was so much a contention. What is important though is it has to be a top four finish. If it's a top three finish, I think that's even better for morale. So at this point, United need to get all the points that they can get. So sky's not falling yet. It was an away match at Crystal Palace. It was designed to be tough.
Crystal Palace have been a bogey for us for quite some time.
It felt like I was watching like Sean Dyche's Burnley again. You know, it just had that vibe, except it wasn't so catastrophically dramatic.
And I will say that it felt like that the lockdown game where we finished it off with like a Rashford and a Martial goal, but we were kind of hanging on for a little bit.
Oh, the one time that we've won at Crystal,
and David De Gea had to make like two or three worldy saves, including one on a free kick.
We got saved by VAR because like Zaha was like not offside and they called him offside.
So the difference wasn't saved by VAR because De Gea made a couple really, really good saves tonight too. So, we're going to put a pin in it And then on the other side of the break, we will talk about a
There were also folks that were telling me yesterday that
damn it, Paulie, that was a really good outro.
Edit it out. Edit it out.
No, enjoy, he's gonna do commercial. It again. You talked over.
Well, now I know how it feels, Colin. Now I know how it feels. Welcome back, listeners. Now it's time to talk about something that's a little bit more fun. Manchester United 2, Manchester City 1. Incredible derby. Definitely was freaking out just because of the size of the game and what it meant and how important it would have been for United to get a result in that game. I would have bit your hand off just to know that we got a point. So to steal two, depending on how you look at that first goal that United scored, it felt really good. It felt really good. Talk about it.
Yeah, no, it was a weird one because I think as much as all the other ones were really good and more fun, etc., this one felt the most calm, I think. It never really seemed like City were threatening. So I went up to Brent and he was sitting with Aaron Mahrez, and I spoke to them at halftime, and I was just like, this game's gonna end 0-0. I was like, City have posed no threat. They can't get near our goal. I was like, we've gotten a few chances, and that's gonna die out as we get tired, and I don't really know where we're getting more chances from. Plus you have to assume City are gonna turn it on a little bit in the second half. But I was like, but they're not getting close to our goal. And then I was actually talking to somebody else, like, this match just feels like both managers were like, 0-0 works for both of us, like, where we don't have to exert energy. Like, and I was saying that as that cross came in and Grealish headed it home. But after that, after like, even when they went 2-1 up, it just, all those other derby wins, just felt like they were hanging on for dear life the last 10 minutes. And this one never did. So very, very enjoyable.
Yeah. I had a little bit different of a viewing experience. So for people who don't know, or don't follow me on Twitter, I had an appendectomy on Friday night. So I was in a hospital bed on Saturday morning, hooked up to a bunch of machines, that, would beep when my heart rate went up. So that was a really interesting first half when it looked like things were about to happen and then either didn't, or, you know, maybe a chance went our way. I was really impressed with Manchester United's approach to the game, though. It definitely didn't seem like the derby earlier this season where either the occasion or the opposition was too big for them. They had a really clear-cut plan. They dealt with City really well. They forced Haaland into positions to try and, you know, just get touches on the ball that were way further away from goal, which is ideal because you don't want him to have the ball anywhere near your goal. And I thought they relied a little, maybe too much, on quick counterattacks. But as both the goals showed, it worked really well against this City back line, which is talented, you know, as usual, because they spend a lot of money there. But even without Ruben Dias or Aymeric Laporte, some of their other first-choice center backs, they dealt pretty well with United for most of the game. When the urgency came in, though, it felt like United were, you know, this is just a team full of players that were up for it. And obviously the second goal was way more, you know, of an actual goal than the first one, because there was no offside call potential there. But yeah, it was great to see for me personally, to, you know, get that win there. But yeah, I kind of agree with Paulie. I was never like as worried about the match once it had started as I have been in previous derbies where, you know, even the ones we won under Solskjaer where we hit them on the break, it was like, this just looked like two teams that knew they belonged on the same pitch as each other.
Yeah, and this was night and day compared to the Manchester Derby at the beginning of the season, where I mean, I think from jump in that game that finished 6-3, I think we all knew that City were a freight train in that game, and United had a lot of growing that they needed to do. A lot of players that they had to get bled into the squad after they went on their spending spree, and things weren't comfortable. Things didn't look right. They still weren't, you know, necessarily implementing the principles taught by Ten Hag, and they went up against a team that, you know, was playing as well as possible to start the season, and they had just added a guy who was, you know, about to hit double digit goals after like 4 or 5 Premier League games. So that game was a buzzsaw. And this one, I think we went into it a little bit more confident. You know, I can relate to the situation that you had, Colin, because of course, the last time I got an organ taken out of my body, it was right ahead of the Europa League final that United won. Of course, it was an abdominal surgery, so every time anything crazy happened and I tensed up, I went into immense pain. So I really feel I can relate to you on that one, especially during the derby this past weekend, because I certainly was animated on my couch. So sitting in a hospital bed would have not been ideal for me.
Yeah, I will say, like, the abdominal pain has definitely set in since getting home, but at the time I was still on the good stuff, you know, so maybe that contributed to the feelings of elation. You know, I mean, I was in a little bit of pain and I was really stiff, but, you know, I wasn't jumping up and down or anything, but it was definitely, I felt okay. You know, I was lively talking to my family and the nurses and the doctor, and, you know, I got up and went for a walk for a little bit. And then, you know, the day that later in the day, Saturday, I came home, I took a nap and I woke up and I was like, oh, whatever they gave me has worn off and I don't want to move anymore.
Funny how that happens. I mean, as far as the I feel like we've kind of hit on some of my takeaways from the derby, just in the same sense of talking about, you know, post Crystal Palace ahead of Arsenal. This was a game that some people maybe got a little ahead of their skis on as far as predicting how the second half of the season was going to go. But I think it was a really good temperature check for the team, you know, by making sure that they can say that they're able to walk out on the same pitch as that team and there's not as grand of a gulf between the levels of talent, the level of coaching that there has been maybe in the past couple of years. I think is that's how you start to build your foundation and start to get rid of that boogeyman and start to approach these games on the front foot and not have to be a shithousing counterattacking team or, you know, having to put together the exact perfect game plan. It could be one of those things where maybe just some talent just beats out their talent at the end of the day.
Right.
Which would be really exciting to get to that point.
Yeah. I think we talked about this last week a little bit where, you know, maybe not expecting a result like this, or, you know, maybe not even really expecting a win, but definitely we were all on the same page that, like, this is the kind of match United needed at this point, where they had just, you know, beaten a bunch of teams that they should beat, or that, you know, maybe they'd struggled with earlier in the season and definitely last season. And they did a really good job. Today against Crystal Palace was a little bit of a different story, but there were other circumstances there. And, you know, we have another one of those on Sunday against Arsenal that we've already talked about. But just having that chance to test yourself, I think, is really underrated. I know it's scary, and it's kind of fun to joke about how scary it is and, you know, being nervous about how your team's going to do, but, like, really nothing beats being in those moments again, you know? And that was part of why the highs under Solskjaer were so great, because, you know, maybe a little bit different from this derby where it felt a little bit like a confirmation of the progress we've made. You know, some of those ones under Solskjaer were maybe not that as much as they were, you know, kind of bringing us back up after you know, other difficult results, because he was a manager who could get players ready for these games and who knew, you know, what it took to beat some of these teams. Definitely City more than, I guess, Liverpool in his time. But yeah, it's just, it's really fun seeing Manchester United play in big games that mean something. And
that's the biggest characteristic of this game too, because even when Solskjaer would beat City, there was still just like, we weren't going to catch up to them.
It's like, we're 15 points in the league table. Yeah.
This game, they did a really good job of, I think, in the buildup too, of just how people were covering the match. Like, this game felt like capital I important, because if United win, they're within a point of City in the table, which is not something, you know, I could have ever envisioned after they pumped us 6-3 back in the fall. So it's one of those things where it's like, not only was this team competitive, but there was maybe a little bit of an expectation that United should get a point out of it. So to get 3 points is absolutely nuts. And then
We're still only like 19, 20 games into the season. So like there could still be a whole unraveling that totally changes the way we see this United team. But I mean, I see what you're saying. There's definitely like a justification for where United are at right now.
Yeah. And it is funny though, because at the end of the day, we still have to, you know, measure ourselves against the, you know, the other top opponents. And if you look at the top four right now, obviously Arsenal sitting there at 47 points. City's at 39. United's at 39. Newcastle's at 38. Where the huge gulf that I'm still noticing, and this is United digging themselves out of the hole that they dug at the beginning of the season. Arsenal, 28 goal differential. Man City, 28 goal differential. Newcastle, 22 goal differential. Manchester United, 8. So this has been a good measuring stick, you know. It's been a weird season with the World Cup in the middle. Started horrendously. It's starting to turn around, because let's not forget, too, in the past, the teams that United are supposed to beat are teams that United did not necessarily beat. They would win the big games, and then they'd blow it against Huddersfield. So it was important that they went on that run, and hopefully they continue to score goals and not find themselves in a 1-0 bare knuckle boxing match with Crystal Palace in the 92nd minute again. So
yeah. So I'm pretty confident about this Arsenal game though. Just I think the derby is, you know, that's the lasting effect of that, at least for this week. And I can say that because, you know, I'm not on pain meds anymore. But no, that is something I'm actually feeling about this Manchester United team. But I get the sense that Erik ten Hag kind of has that shared attribute with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you know, or whatever trait you want to put on his video game character of like, this guy knows how to prepare for the games that people are going to talk about. He kind of showed that earlier in the season, and that was, you know, what steadied the ship after the Brentford loss. We may have to see something similar against Arsenal, what we saw earlier in the season. But I don't know. I trust him to do it.
Yeah. And this could be one of those things too. You know, I always urge people just to keep things in perspective. This game is set up for Arsenal to win. Let's not get too bent. I understand all the rivalries and all the historical things that go into the game. But at the same time, too, I think Erik ten Hag has to look at everything pragmatically. I don't think he's shipping any games. He wants to win everyone that he plays in. Otherwise, he wouldn't be a coach. But right after Arsenal, this team is going to play again January 25th in the EFL Cup semifinal, leg one. And then 3 days after that, they're going to play in the fourth round of the FA Cup. And while if you use the T word, that was premature, United has a real chance to bring home one or two trophies this year. And that's got to be at the forefront of Erik ten Hag's mind too, because this team is starved of having any kind of silverware at the end of the season that you can use as a foundational building piece. I mean, if they bring home an FA Cup, they bring home a Carabao Cup, God forbid they beat Barcelona and they move on to eventually win a Europa League title, this
Hot one, baby.
That's the kind of stuff that then Erik ten Hag goes into the summer with whatever limited budget he's going to have, and he says, this is my project. Do you want to be a part of it?
And so, pot one of the Champions League.
Exactly. I mean, this is how he gets started off on the right foot in his first season, and he builds this thing. So that's all exciting. And the last little bit of vibes that we'll talk about, and then we'll end this because we're running a little long here.
You guys might have noticed, but Paulie had to dip out.
Yeah, that's why we got to talk now.
Yeah.
Jadon Sancho is back in training, baby. We're not rushing him. Erik ten Hag is being very pragmatic about it. He said when Sancho is ready to play, he will play. He had to take a sabbatical. I think it's really unfair, the amount of lumps that he had to take, whether it was perceived by himself, whether it was directed at him through social media or in the press. You really couldn't ask for a worse start to kind of how his Man United career has gone. And I think also Ten Hag recognizes, one, the talent that he's got in Sancho, two, the financial investment that the club has in Sancho. And he said, let's do this right. So we're seeing him in training photos. He's back at practice. When he's ready, he'll be put into the team, as the manager said. And, you know, we might get lucky enough to say that Jadon Sancho is basically like a January transfer window signing when he finally comes back in the spring.
Yeah, I've got my eye on the FA Cup fourth round for Jadon Sancho's return. I know it's not that long from now, and maybe Erik ten Hag will want to keep him in training a little bit more, but he's also, you know, a little bit pragmatic when it comes to keeping his personnel fresh. And if he suddenly has this situation where he can rotate his forwards a little bit, I think he would take it. And I also, you know, that Jadon Sancho returned to training this week obviously indicates that he's far enough along, because it wasn't like he wasn't training or anything. He didn't have an injury. This was Erik ten Hag and Jadon Sancho decided that he should go away. He should train with specific coaches that they had set aside for him, and he was going to train on his own away from the team. So now he's back in the fold. He's made some social media cameos with Marcus Rashford and teammates. It seems like, you know, things are much more positive, which is good to see, because it did seem like a factor of this was mental. He stopped playing at some point, and then it became he had an illness for a little while, which was undisclosed. And then Erik ten Hag discussed a little bit about how mentally as well as physically he just wasn't ready to play for Manchester United right now. And, you know, like you said, this is somebody who the club has spent a lot of, you know, money on. And they've waited a long time to bring him in, so they obviously value him. He's also the kind of player that Erik ten Hag wants on the wing, apart from just being a really, you know, promising individual talent. And he's somebody that a lot of players in the squad really took to. And I know, you know, he's obviously close friends with Marcus Rashford. It'll be good to see him get this chance, because he was one of the players alongside Saka and Rashford who suffered horrible racist abuse after England's loss at Wembley to Italy. That took a toll on him, along with everything else that happened at Manchester United last year. Maybe he did just need to take some time away. I think it's a good thing that he and ten Hag were on good enough terms that they could have that discussion, and that they could decide that that was a solution for them. And he took that time away. He worked on himself. He worked on his game, and now he's back. And hopefully we get to see it a little bit sooner rather than later.
Yep. He's been out training with the League of Shadows and Ra's al Ghul. So it's just going to be so much fun to watch him play, because most importantly, I'm just happy for him personally, because for all intent and purposes, he seems like one super good dude. He was a player that we were really excited to see play for Manchester United for a long time. One, because of his talent. Two, because he just seems like a really vibey guy who obviously was going to acquiesce into the squad to really well in it. And it's been unfortunate that it didn't immediately take, but I'll tell you what, if we get the footballer that was playing in the Champions League for Dortmund, playing in Erik ten Hag's system, we saw this, we saw glimpses of it in the preseason. Something very, very special could happen. So good vibes. Good vibes. Wishing all the best to Jadon Sancho. When you're ready, I cannot wait to watch you put on a red shirt and ball out of your mind again. And that feels like a good note to end the podcast on, Colin. Thank you, Paulie, for being able to be on for about two-thirds of this. It's always difficult during the week trying to do these podcasts because of everybody's work schedules, but glad we're able to get together. Glad to see Colin's feeling better after his surgery and making memes about his appendix, which were incredible. Colin, you got any last thoughts?
If you feel stomach pain in your lower right abdomen, go see your physician because your appendix might explode, and that's not fun.
Or you're watching the Jaguars go down 27-0 to the Los Angeles Chargers, but you know what?
Yeah.
Like the Jaguars, Colin came back. So
that's right. No, yeah, funny story. I was watching that game, and I was nauseous because the anesthesia was wearing off. It was later in the day Saturday, and I dozed off when the Chargers were up 27-0. They had just scored that second touchdown. And I remember kind of thinking, like, the Chargers haven't really taken control of this game. It's like they've had like five turnovers and they've had to settle for field goals like three times. So I could see a way back into it. And then I woke up and it was like 30-20 and the Jaguars were driving. And I was like, ah.
And you're wondering why Nathan's nice. Not answering his phone. I was locked in. I was radio silence.
I didn't answer anyone on my phone that day. I could not look at my phone.
Well, with that, we'll end the podcast. Listeners, hope you guys have a good rest of your week. Get excited. Arsenal on Sunday. 11:30 Eastern here in the States. Add or subtract hours, depending on where you live. And we will be back next week to hopefully talk about earning some points at the Emirates and previewing and or talking about hopefully a win at Nottingham Forest. So till next time, guys.